Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an attempt to understand why Donald Trump persists in trying to make deals favorable to Russia on Putin's terms, and speak with Dr. Michael Carpenter, a former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense with responsibility for Russia, who served as a foreign policy advisor to Vice President Biden and as director for Russia at the National Security Council. Now a senior director of the Biden Center for Diplomacy and Global Engagement at the University of Pennsylvania, he joins us to discuss his article at Defense One, "The U.S. Should Steer Clear of Russian Help in Syria." We'll look into the folly of working with the Russians to combat ISIS, since Putin's strategy is to support his proxy Assad at all costs, without recognizing that Assad is the main reason why Islamic terrorists have a foothold in Syria. Then we'll examine the reasons why Trump and the Republicans have sold their souls to Russia following a recent poll that finds 48% of Republicans see nothing wrong with Donald Trump Jr.'s meeting with Russian operatives offering to help elect Trump and damage his opponent. James Kirchick, a journalist and foreign correspondent who was a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution and the author of The End of Europe, Dictators, Demagogues, and the Coming Dark Age, joins us to discuss his article at Politico, "How the GOP Became the Party of Putin." And since Trump's core supporters live in a bubble of delusion impervious to facts and evidence, we will assess the extent to which Trump's advisors like Bannon and Gawker have followed the playbook of Putin's media guru, Vladislav Surkov, to create a parallel universe of alternative facts in which there is no objective truth, but where only subjective truth matters. Then finally, we will speak with Abby Gluck, a professor of law and the faculty director of the Solomon Center for Health Law and Policy at Yale Law School. She joins us to try to make sense of the many tweets and statements coming from Donald Trump in the wake of the Republican Senate's latest failure to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, which Trump is praising as, quote, a pretty impressive vote by any standard, while declaring he wants Obamacare to fail and that, quote, Republicans are not going to own it. And joining us now is Dr. Michael Carpenter, former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense with responsibility for Russia, Ukraine, Eurasia, the Balkans, and conventional arms control. He previously served in the White House as a foreign policy advisor to Vice President Joe Biden and was director for Russia at the National Security Council. Prior to that, he was a career foreign service officer with the State Department, and he's now senior director of the Biden Center for Diplomacy and Global Engagement at the University of Pennsylvania. And he has an article at Defense One, "The U.S. Should Steer Clear of Russian Help in Syria." Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Michael Carpenter.
Glad to be with you.
And I think the puzzlement about Donald Trump's attitudes to the Russians, in particular his penchant for making excuses for Putin and quite often appearing to be hard on allies like Angela Merkel, hanging up on the Australian Prime Minister, etc. There's a puzzlement there about why be nice to our enemies and unpleasant to our allies. But let's start with the G20 meeting. We don't know what went on in that meeting. The so-called adults in the room, Generals Mattis and McMaster, were not invited in. But on the surface, to my mind, there was a great disadvantage to the United States. You basically had two businessmen, Tillerson and Trump, negotiating with a foreign policy pro Lavrov and a former intelligence professional, Putin. And my sense is that our side got hosed. Just in terms of the meeting itself, how did it strike you?
Well, just in terms of the lineup, I think the U.S. was at a disadvantage for exactly the reasons you say. I think between President Trump and Secretary Tillerson, they had less than 12 months of government experience, whereas on the other side, you know, something like several decades worth. So clearly they were novices compared to Putin and Lavrov. And I think it shows in terms of how the meeting was read out, but also in terms of the substance of what was discussed.
But there seems to be a broader problem, though, with this recent poll coming out that 48% of Republicans think that Donald Trump Jr. was right to take that meeting in Trump Tower with Russians who might well have been intelligence officials promising dirt on Hillary Clinton. The president himself, of course, has defended the meeting, saying, oh, it was nothing. But, you know, of course, people in politics deal with opposition research. But my understanding is that...
Yeah, that's not true. I mean, of course, you may be interested in opposition research, but not when an adversarial foreign power is the one that's offering you the dirt on your opposition candidate.
Right.
And that's a huge difference.
Sure. And I believe that normal people would have immediately called the FBI. So, but I brought it up to indicate that this is not just a problem that we have with the president, but it seems that the Republican Party itself is in denial. We've got a congressman out here, Dana Rohrabacher, who is Trump's biggest champion. And that's not to suggest that on the political left, there's not apologists like Oliver Stone made this four-hour Valentine about Putin for Showtime. So there's something peculiar going on. Have you got your finger on it at all, Dr. Carpenter?
Well, you know, it's hard to say what's happening. I mean, I think a lot of Republicans, certainly in Congress, are hesitant to cross the president at this point in time. I think in private, a lot of them are a lot more worried about what's going on in terms of the possible connections between Trump and Russia, and I mean those connections that are being investigated right now, than they let on to be. And so, you know, you've seen some of the leaked reports about concerns, both about Trump and Rohrabacher by prominent Republicans. And I think that's probably, I suspect at least, that that's probably a commonly held view in private. But in public right now, they're still in lockstep with their party leadership.
And of course, you're referring to the meeting that took place, a high-level meeting with top Republicans of the House, with Paul Ryan and Kevin McCarthy mentioned that he thought both Trump and Rohrabacher were on the Russian payroll. And he said, swear to God. And then, of course, immediately the speaker
immediately
said,
Paul Ryan tried to shush him up. Yeah,
right, exactly. And we know that that's true because Evan McMullen, who ran for president, was in that meeting and has verified the facts. So there is something going on there. But you're somebody who has actually dealt with the Russians. And for example, in Syria, you met with the delegation of U.S. generals with your Russian counterparts across the table trying to negotiate the very thing that Trump keeps talking about. You know, after this G20 meeting, his big takeaway was that, oh, we're going to have a ceasefire in Syria. Well, that didn't exactly go very far. So tell us about it seems to me there's a massive gulf between the practical experience that you've had and this kind of aspirational thinking on the part of Trump.
Well, so, I mean, it bothers me and it worries me that Mr. Trump wants desperately to do some sort of deal with Russia almost at any cost. And you have to wonder why that is and why he spoke so admiringly and fawningly about Mr. Putin during the campaign and to this very day. And in fact, when confronted with information about killings that go on in Russia, of journalists sort of brushed it off and said, well, that happens here in the United States. I mean, that's just that type of rhetoric I find outrageous. I think a lot of other Americans do as well. But as far as cooperating with Russia, I mean, this is a power that sees the U.S. And the West more broadly as enemy number one. And so the notion that we can have our interests align in Syria is a false one, because Russia wants to take the U.S. down a couple notches in Syria. They have no interest in trying to work in a creative and constructive way to have a political resolution to the conflict there. What they want to do is prop up Assad, and they're working with their allies on the ground, who, by the way, are Lebanese Hezbollah and Iran. So doing a deal with Russia and Syria is very much like doing a deal with Iran or doing a deal with Lebanese Hezbollah. I don't think most Americans would think that that would be a good idea for us to work with either of those two actors to try to achieve some sort of modus vivendi in Syria. But that's essentially what you would be doing if you negotiated with Russia.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Michael Carpenter, who's a former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense with responsibilities for Russia, Ukraine, Eurasia, the Balkans, and conventional arms control, and previously served in the White House as a foreign policy advisor to Vice President Joe Biden and as Director for Russia at the National Security Council. And prior to that, he was a career Foreign Service officer with the State Department, and he's now a Senior Director of the Biden Center for Diplomacy and Global Engagement at the University of Pennsylvania. And he has an article at Defense One, "The U.S. Should Steer Clear of Russian Help in Syria." So if indeed there is any collusion, and I guess at some point or other we'll know from what the Robert Mueller's investigation is looking into, there appears to be from just this recent email chain from Donald Jr. that there's evidence of collusion But, you know, putting that aside, could you make the case that the fact that we have such an erratic, inexperienced president who has alienated allies, etc., and apparently the reports that you hear from the G20 was that he wasn't so much shunned, but at least people were kind of uncomfortable with him, and he was very much the odd man out. Has Putin, in effect, got what he wants in the sense that we have an unusual situation with a president who is weakening America? I think, just personally, I think it's happening at an extraordinary rate, but that seems to be the consensus of a lot of the foreign reports we got from the G20, at least, you know, headlines in the New York Times, you know, U.S. once dominated the G20, now isolated on the sidelines.
Absolutely. I mean, Putin must be overjoyed. Trump has not only criticized NATO, but he's been had a very adversarial relationship with a lot of our closest allies, including Angela Merkel, but also with others. He's been rude over the phone. He's chastised them in public, and he seemed to make common cause with Mr. Putin, who poses probably the greatest threat, together with ISIS and other extremist groups, to Europe and to our vision of a Europe whole, free, and at peace. So, he's got it all backwards, but it's music to Mr. Putin's ears, because he is fomenting a rift between the United States on the one hand and our European allies on the other. There's also chaos and confusion back here in Washington and at home, and that is exactly what Mr. Putin wants, so that he can carry out his subversive activities in other countries. And it's also diverting U.S. attention from other challenges, like the Syrian civil war, like the situation in Afghanistan and other parts of the world. So all of this is very, very damaging to our national security. And the direction that we're going in doesn't leave one with any hope that things are going to get better anytime soon, unfortunately.
Well, I think a lot of liberals and progressives take a certain comfort in the idea that there are some adults in the room with General McMaster and General Mattis, but I'm not entirely sure whether they're actually in the room. I mean, we know that, for example, on Afghanistan that you just mentioned, that Stephen Bannon and Jared Kushner, along with Feinberg, the hedge fund billionaire who owns DynCorp, and Eric Prince, the founder of the mercenary army Blackwater, who has a private army now in the Emirates in the Gulf, they apparently have floated this idea of privatizing the war in Afghanistan. Now, I understand they met with General Mattis on Saturday, and he shot it down. But the fact that it even got as far as it did is just extraordinary to my mind.
Well, it's true. And, you know, there are a couple reasons why General McMaster may have been excluded from the meeting with Putin. One is that on the U.S. side, the sort of the Trump inner circle, the West Wing advisors, if you will, Jared and Ivanka and others, decided that it would be better to minimize leaks by excluding him. That's one possibility. The other possibility is that the Russians saw an advantage in having Putin and Lavrov in the meeting, and so they proposed only those two, and the U.S. went along with it, which, if that was the scenario, that would have been a huge mistake, a rookie mistake on our part. But in either case, you have, precisely as you said, someone who has a sophisticated understanding of the threat Russia poses, who is not in the room, who is not privy to the conversation, not able to correct mistakes that are made. And by the way, you know, one of the interesting things about the G20 is that not only was there that bilateral in which Trump essentially gave away the store by essentially acknowledging that he was going to move on from the greatest influence operation that Russia has ever directed against the United States. That in itself is a huge blow to our national security. But then in addition to that bilateral meeting, Ian, there was, I've heard reports, there was a separate meeting where during the leaders' dinner that same day, in the middle of the dinner, Mr. Trump went over to Mr. Putin and sat down next to him in an empty chair, and they carried on for the better part of an hour in a very jovial, backslapping type of way. And so we haven't had any readout of that second conversation, which was a fairly lengthy one, and where a lot of business could have been done. And so, you know, you take that, you take the Donald Trump Jr. meeting, you take the Kushner meeting with a former and former is in quotes because there's never really a former Russian intelligence officer who now runs a major Russian bank. All of these meetings have sort of come out in drips and drabs. There was no transparency about them from the start. It's only as the media starts to dig that this stuff comes out. And you can't help but think that there's a lot of obfuscation going on about the exact nature of the conversations between this administration and the Russian side.
Well, it's my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, Michael Carpenter, but Fiona Hill, who is the National Security Council expert on Russia, formerly with the Brookings Institution, somebody that I've known over the years who speaks Russian, apparently the Russians vetoed her. They refer to her as a hawk.
Well, I don't know if that's true. Fiona, I've known Fiona for years as well. I think very, very highly of her. She's a true expert on Russia. She's written a great book on Mr. Putin. In fact, it's a book that Mr. Trump ought to read. It ought to be at the top of his reading list. But if they vetoed her and we didn't push back, again, that's a concession which speaks very poorly of the arrangements for the meeting. She certainly should have been in the meeting. She should have been a note taker there. And McMaster should have been in that meeting, too.
So just to do, I touched on the Afghanistan privatization with Eric Prince, who, of course, is the brother of the Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos. And the fact that they had that meeting in itself is pretty alarming. Do you have any concerns about the idea that you have players like Eric Prince with private armies in the Gulf that could, in fact, trigger, you know, wider conflicts? The idea that they, that Bannon and company, and it's not just Bannon that concerns me, at least, there's a sort of troika with this Hungarian fascist, Sebastian Gorka and Stephen Miller, seem to be the brains trust along with Jared. And as I mentioned earlier, I'm not sure that how much comfort we can take in the idea that the adults in the room have some sway or whether indeed they are in the room. But the fact that they were able to get this proposal to privatize the war in Afghanistan, which is absolutely insane, it scares the hell out of me, frankly.
Well, look, absolutely. And early in the administration in January, there was a move afoot to try to lift sanctions against Russia. And as soon as some of the bureaucrats within the administration got wind of it, and it leaked out into the press and then over to Capitol Hill, you know, it was put on the back burner. But the fact that that initiative was even attempted is incredibly alarming. It would have been a concession from the get-go, which would have been disastrous for our policy on Russia. And some of these other meetings that you've alluded to sort of testifies to the fact that you have this national security professional apparatus. You mentioned the generals McMaster and Mattis and Kelly over at the Department of Homeland Security on the one hand. And then you've got the inner circle, you've got the folks in the West Wing, members of Trump's family, but some of these other surrogates who are on the outside, not formally in the White House, but speak on behalf of the president. That's a very dangerous situation to be in. You don't want to ever have a sort of a parallel group of advisors that have their own agenda, which is at odds with the members of the cabinet who are formally executing policy in the executive branch. It's just a recipe for, A, failure of policy, but, B, it could lead to nefarious types of policy outcomes. And, you know, you think about, for example, the attitude towards the European Union. Well, Mr. Bannon has been incredibly hostile and antithetical to the EU as an institution. But the EU is, you know, the basis for U.S.-EU trade, for American prosperity with Europe. It's sort of the basis for our transatlantic alliance. And so the notion that we would want to weaken the EU from our end because we don't value the fact that it's a supranational institution, to me, is folly. But it also, it displays this rift that you have between the professionals. Like, surely McMaster and Mattis understand the value of NATO and the EU, but then you have these ideologues on the other side, some of whom you mentioned, who do not, and who in fact take a very hostile, antithetical view to both NATO and the EU.
Well, just in closing, Dr. Michael Carpenter, you mentioned the deficit of patriotism here. So, to some extent, there have been a couple of Republican senators, Lindsey Graham and John McCain, who have been critical, and to some extent also has Marco Rubio has been critical, although he did seem to back off a little in order to get his deal to cut back on the initiative that Barack Obama took with the Cubans. But is there a chance, you think, or do you see any kind of indications that the Republicans, particularly the Republican senators and the foreign policy people, will, and it is an irony to think, you know, I used to work in arms control years ago in the Soviet days, and they, Russians actually, or the Soviets actually preferred to deal with Republicans. They were a little leery of Democrats. But it seems like the Republican Party has squandered its foreign policy credentials. I think people like Brent Scowcroft have got to be really in pain over this. But now, is there a chance that any of them will pony up in respite of the statistic I read out about this recent poll that indicates that 48% of Republicans think that Donald Trump Jr.'s meeting with the Russians was okay?
Well, you know, but that's a poll of the population at large. You know, I think I actually do have faith in some of the Republican leaders in Congress. You know, I testified on Russia with the Senate Foreign Relations Committee in July of 2016 when I was still a Pentagon official. And some of the toughest questions were from some of the Republican members of the committee, including Chairman Corker, but also others. And, you know, if I don't think it's really possible for them to do an about-face on this, and I don't think they will. I think they understand, I think intellectually they understand, but I also think in their hearts they understand that Russia's trying to subvert our democracy. And so I think they'll come around eventually. And I think, you know, in the House of Representatives, I think some of the members are maybe a little bit less savvy in terms of their understanding of foreign affairs and the threat that Russia poses. But I think with time, they are starting to understand. I also testified since I've been out of government, and I spoke about Russian influence operations and how they operate in the gray zone. And I have to say, in that testimony as well, I found that, you know, the questions were equally incisive from the Republican side as from the Democratic side. So at the end of the day, I guess I do have some hope that Republicans will see this as a threat to our national security, and that they will rally around the flag and they'll do the right thing. You know, it may take some time before we get there. And obviously politics is a huge issue here and it'll get in the way. But ultimately, you know, I do have faith that that they will understand the threat and act accordingly.
Well, Dr. Michael Carpenter, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Michael Carpenter, who's a former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense with responsibility for Russia, Ukraine, Eurasia, the Balkans, and conventional arms control, and previously served in the White House as a foreign policy advisor to Vice President Joe Biden and as Director for Russia at the National Security Council. And prior to that, he was a career Foreign Service officer with the State Department, and he's now Senior Director of the Biden Center for Diplomacy and Global Engagement at the University of Pennsylvania. And he has an article, Defense One, the U.S. should steer clear of Russian help in Syria. We're going to take a brief station break and be back examining the reasons why Trump and the Republicans have sold their souls to Russia.
Russia with love, I fly to you, much wiser since my goodbye to you.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is James Kirchick, who's a journalist and foreign correspondent who has reported from Southern and North Africa, the Middle East, Central Asia, across the European continent and the Caucasus. He's a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution. And his latest book just out is The End of Europe, Dictators, Demagogues, and the Coming Dark Age. And he has an op-ed at Politico, How the GOP Became the Party of Putin. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Kirchick.
Thank you for having me.
And the subtitle to your article at Politico, James Kirchick, is Republicans Have Sold Their Souls to Russia and Trump Isn't the Only Reason Why. What is going on here? Because the people that normally were the red baiters during the McCarthy era, the communist haters during the Cold War, it was pretty clear where they stood. And paradoxically, of course, the Soviets actually preferred to deal with Republicans. They didn't quite trust Democrats in terms of foreign policy, but nevertheless, the record is pretty clear on that. So now you have the former hawks making excuses for Putin on the right, and then on the left you've got people like Oliver Stone doing a four-hour Valentine for a Putin on Showtime. So it's pretty topsy-turvy, isn't it?
Yeah, on the right, there's several things. One, I mean, Russia is no longer the communist, atheistic, you know, godless empire that it was. And so for religious conservatives who didn't like the fact that the Soviet Union was atheistic, there's that issue is no longer there. And Putin has actually been very good at trying to portray himself and his regime as being sort of this last bastion of Christianity. And that's taken hold among some on the right. There's also just the sheer opportunism in the fact that, you know, Donald Trump, for reasons that are still mysterious, has this affinity for Putin, and he was the nominee, and so Republicans are just going to get in line behind the man who is now the president. But in the article that I wrote, I think there's something deeper going on, which is really that the conservative movement, such as it is, particularly under the Obama years, really just became a kind of outrage industry. And you can see that in the book publishers and the radio hosts and a certain television network. A lot of money is made in sort of peddling resentment in this country. And there really aren't many ideas. And so I think the notion of sort of principled opposition to a dictatorship or a regime that is causing all this, you know, problems in our own electoral system by hacking the Democrats, that just wasn't there anymore. And it made the conservative movement, I think, quite susceptible to manipulation because they don't really have principles and they don't really stand for the things that they did, at least when Ronald Reagan was president.
Well, I suppose, in a way, you're describing Dana Rohrabach out here in California. It's completely mystifying what's going on there. I know at that meeting, Kevin McCarthy, a very select group of the top House Republicans with Paul Ryan, McCarthy sort of said, you know, swear to God, you know, Dana Rohrabach and Trump are on Putin's payroll or something. I'm paraphrasing what they said. And, you know, that actually happened. And the guy that ran as an independent on the Republican side, Evan McMullen, was in that meeting and has verified it. So it definitely happened. And then immediately Ryan said, let's not talk about that. that's pretty amazing, isn't it? If the number two guy in the House on the Republican side has that, you know, more than a suspicion, but, you know, so he says swear to God. I mean, what did you make of
that? I don't know. I mean, if there was evidence of that, I think we would. I mean, if it's true, I think we should investigate it. I mean, if he's taking money from a foreign government, that's probably illegal. Dana Rohrabach has always been kind of an odd duck, although his transformation has been really one of the more remarkable ones. I mean, this was a man who actually went to Afghanistan to fight the Russians with Mujahideen. And he worked as a speechwriter for Ronald Reagan. And over the past couple of years, he's been one of, if not the most outspoken defender of Vladimir Putin in the U.S. Congress. I think for him, part of it is explained by this very effective narrative that the Russians have been putting out for quite a while now, which is that they are allies in the struggle against Islam. Or Islamic terrorism, if you will, and that there's a civilizational war going on, and that whatever differences we might have with Russia on, you know, little things like invading and annexing Ukraine, at the end of the day, we're all basically, you know, Christian members of this Judeo-Christian civilization that's struggling against the Muslim hordes. And I think that, if you listen to Dana Rocker, that's basically the line that he's taking. That's the line that other people are taking, like Franklin Graham, and I think a lot of people on the religious right are attracted to this. It's complete nonsense. Their way of fighting Islamic terrorism is to basically level entire cities. You can just look at what they did in Chechnya, killing tens of thousands of innocent people, women and children. And as far as, you know, Syria goes, which is where this argument is really being operationalized, that we should be allies with Russia and fighting ISIS. ISIS is not really the target of Russia's military effort in Syria. They're mainly trying to defend the Assad regime, and they're mostly attacking the nationalist rebels who are fighting him. They're not fighting ISIS. So this is there's really nothing to this argument. But unfortunately, a lot of people, not only in America, but in Europe, on the political right, are susceptible to it.
And again, I'm speaking with James Kirchick, who's a journalist and foreign correspondent who has reported from Southern and North Africa, the Middle East, Central Asia, across the European continent and the Caucasus. He is a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C., a correspondent for The Daily Beast and a columnist for Tablet. And his latest book just out is The End of Europe, Dictators, Demagogues, and the Coming Dark Age. And he has an op-ed at Politico, How the GOP Became the Party of Putin. So in your article, of course, you cite the recent polls that say 48% of Republicans think Donald Jr. was right to take the meeting with the Russian lawyer who is rumored to have intelligence ties. Certainly the other Russian that came in with her definitely has a background in Soviet military counterintelligence. There was a translator there. Nobody's been able to talk to him. But what was released in that email chain was pretty damning, was it not? And now we know that the Crown Prosecutor they're referring to is a specialist in setting up, you know, honey trap type videos. That's how Putin rose to power, was the prosecutor was looking into corruption in the Yeltsin administration, and Putin, through this fellow Chika, was able to set up a honey trap video, which may not have even been the prosecutor in it. He swears he wasn't in the video, but they played it all over state TV, and they even had the hookers come in and talk about it. And that, of course, destroyed this guy and so forth. So just on the surface, you have to ask yourself, what are these people doing talking to these sleazy, murderous people with so much blood on their hands, including Magnitsky's?
I think it just shows you the complete and utter unscrupulousness, the lack of patriotism of the Trump clan. The fact that their first impulse upon being contacted by someone claiming to have information working for the Russian government, and that they're trying to sabotage the U.S. presidential election, the first reaction of any patriotic American, I don't care if you're a Republican or conservative who doesn't like Hillary Clinton, the first thing you do is you call the FBI. You don't write back, oh, this is wonderful, let's see the information. And I don't think that the notion of even calling the FBI never even entered Donald Trump's head. And this is why I say in the piece that I think the Russians really read the situation very well. They could tell that people like Donald Trump, the people around him, many people in the Republican Party, despite their claims of being patriots and God-fearing Americans, at the end of the day, would be willing to work with avowed enemies of this country, the Russian KGB, as long as they could use that to defeat Hillary Clinton. At the end of the day, they hate Hillary Clinton more than they do Vladimir Putin. And that, to me, is just, you know, I can't abide that. I can't understand that. I can't defend it. I'm not sure if anything that Donald Trump Jr. did was necessarily illegal. We don't really know what went on in that meeting. I think at the very least we have an intent to collude with Russia, but I don't think we have evidence yet of actual criminal activity.
Right, but it's reasonable to assume that the meeting itself, the fact that it took place, could have been seen as a, you know, an opening gambit. I mean, the fact that they took the meeting in itself is sufficiently incriminating. So maybe the Russians were basically...
Well, it's morally incriminating. I'm not sure. I mean, again, this is all being investigated by Robert Mueller, as it should be. But I'm hesitant to make accusations that have legal force, unless we see all the evidence. I mean, I definitely, like I said, I think I spoke to you a month or two ago, and I said, you know, we may find out that the Trumps are guilty of nothing more than being unscrupulous and unpatriotic, and that there's no laws against what they did. And maybe we need to come up with new laws. Okay, maybe we need to devise certain regulations about the ways in which foreigners can involve themselves in our political campaigns. I haven't seen evidence yet of illegal activity, and I'm not defending the Trumps when I'm saying this. I think that they're completely disgusting in the way that they've behaved, and as are many of the people defending them. But just from a legal standpoint, I think I have not seen the evidence yet of illegal behavior.
Well, there is an area, though, where it seems that the Trump campaign, and particularly Stephen Bannon, have borrowed from the playbook of Surkoff, who was a theater director who became Putin's kind of media guru. And there's no question that Surkoff's idea of via Putin and via Putin's control of the media in Russia to spread this idea, and of course they do it in English through their English language network, RT and Sputnik, to sort of instill in the public through sort of chaos and contradiction the notion that there's no such thing anymore as objective truth, that the truth is subjective. And that has been extremely effective, and that explains how Trump has about, 35% at least of the American people simply believing anything that he says and not believing a thing that the mainstream press, which they call fake news, puts out. That in itself is an extraordinary achievement. And here he is just yesterday, Trump, talking about all the amazing bills that he's passed and how he surpassed FDR and Harry Truman in getting stuff done. And none of it's true. But that doesn't mean that his people don't believe it. So is there a connection there, in not just necessarily a physical connection, but at least an intellectual connection?
It might be giving Trump and Bannon a little too much credit to think that they are aware of Surkov and his methods. It might be. I'm not sure. I'd be interested to ask Steve Bannon this if I ever had the chance to interview him. But I definitely agree with your analysis that it's a completely cynical attempt to basically destroy the notion of objective truth. And I have a friend, Peter Pomerantsev, who wrote an excellent book about Russia called Nothing is True and Everything is Possible. And he wrote that book several years ago before the prospect of Donald Trump even becoming, you know, president was on anyone's mind. And I think if you go back and read that book today, it's very eerie. He wrote about Russia, but the ways in which it could be applied to the United States is very creepy. And I think you're absolutely right in sort of destroying public trust in institutions, in the news media. I mean, this is from the toolkit of authoritarians. Because once there is no truth, or once the traditional outlets are responsible for covering government and life and the news media, which is supposed to be an independent arbiter of these things, once people no longer trust it, then it does make it a lot easier for a demagogic leader like Donald Trump to convince people that what he's doing is right.
Well, I recently spoke with David Rothkopf, who was formerly the head of foreign policy and now a columnist for the Washington Post. And he had a piece recently in the Washington Post that posited the notion that the greatest threat to U.S. national security is the president of the United States himself. What's your sense in that regard? Because we can't still figure out why he goes out of his way to make excuses for Putin and then trashes allies like Angela Merkel and hangs up on the Australian Prime Minister, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a fundamental puzzlement that's been there from day one. And what's your sense of... Is it that at the end of the day, it doesn't matter that Putin meddled in the elections one way or the other, or colluded, if indeed he did? At the end of the day, he's gotten what he wants, which is this man in the Oval Office is weakening America at warp speed.
Yeah. Well, I said from the very beginning that the reason why the Russians wanted Trump was not in particular for any policy decisions. Trump may lighten up the pressure on sanctions on Ukraine. They're all a bunch of, you know, just discrete specific policy issues, the Magnitsky sanctions, all these things. I think that's kind of small ball. I think looking at the broader picture, the reason why the Russians wanted Trump is because they wanted to discredit the United States as the leader of the free world. And it's hard for me to think of someone, of anyone, who more discredits the United States' traditional leadership position than Donald Trump. He makes it incredibly difficult for pro-American political leaders around the world to operate because he's toxic, and he helps anti-American political figures around the world. Just having Donald Trump in office in that sense is a real tragedy and a real problem. And I think Putin loves to be able to point at the West and say, oh, democracy, it's all a sham. Better than us. This whole moral relativeness that he's been promoting for years. And I think Trump makes that mission a lot easier. It's a lot easier to say the West is just a bunch of, you know, bankers stealing money from the poor and all these other horrible things. If you can point at Donald Trump, who's president of the United States. So I think that's why the Russians did what they did.
Well, just in closing then, there has been a slight weakening of this kind of firewall of the core support in those that believe in Kellyanne Conway's alternative facts, the core support for Trump. And there was recently a poll from ABC and the Washington Post that had 89% of Trump's voters believing that he was honest and trustworthy and would fulfill his promises. And at this, by 78% margin, I believe they thought that the mainstream media basically propagates fake news. So that is his hermetically sealed world. But it seems to be being chipped away with. A recent poll following the Donald Jr. Trump Tower meeting with the Russians seems to have eroded that a little. So what do you think can be done to reach these people to understand that this is a really bad situation, to having this man, you know, he's a danger to America's national security, if you accept David Rothkopf's thesis?
Yeah. I think he's been able to skate by because there hasn't really been a major foreign policy crisis since he's been president. I think once that happens and he reacts impulsively, as he's wont to do, I think I hope that the American people at that point would have a bit more, clarity in seeing what kind of man he is. But, you know, we're 8 or 9 months into the presidency so far, and there's been a lot of, you know, embarrassing moments. There's been a lot of summits that where he said silly things, where he's humiliated foreign leaders and whatnot. But that hasn't really been a crisis yet. And, you know, God forbid when that happens, as it inevitably will. I would expect the numbers of Americans who are seeing through Trump would increase.
Well, James Kerchick, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with James Kerchick, who's a journalist and foreign correspondent who has reported from southern North Africa, the Middle East, Central Asia, across the European continent and the Caucasus. He is a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C., and a correspondent for The Daily Beast and a columnist for Tablet. And his latest book just out is The End of Europe, Dictators, Demagogues, and the Coming Dark Age. And he has an op-ed at Politico, How the GOP Became the Party of Putin. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back trying to make sense of the many tweets and statements coming from Donald Trump in the wake of the Republican Senate's latest failure to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Abby Gluck, who's a professor of law and the faculty director of the Solomon Center for Health, Law, and Policy at Yale Law School, where she focuses on Congress and the political process, federalism, civil procedure, and health law. She has extensive experience working as a lawyer in all levels of government and clerked for U.S. Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Welcome to Background Briefing, Abby Gluck.
Thanks for having me back, Ian.
Thank you for joining us, Abby. And it's pretty extraordinary to try and figure out President Trump's reaction to what would seem to be a political blow. He's basically saying that the vote was very impressive by any standard. And then he's also saying, I'm not going to own it, referring to Obamacare. And I can tell you the Republicans are not going to own it. And in general, he's been tweeting out saying, we will return. And then again, he tweeted out today, as I've always said, let Obamacare fail and then come together and do a great health care plan. Stay tuned. So given that he's turning a defeat into a victory and claiming success, and also, of course, yesterday, Donald Trump claimed that he had the greatest legislative record in an early presidency in history, beating FDR's and Harry Truman. So I suppose in a way it's hard to find out or pin this fellow down, but in general, surely this is a bit of a blow to the Trump administration.
Yeah, I mean, I think by now we all know that you need to sort of suspend disbelief to believe half the things that President Trump claims that he's accomplished. By any measure, this is an extraordinary failure of the effort to repeal and replace Obamacare. What we've seen over the last few days has been quite remarkable. We saw not only the Senate version of the bill founder based on the number of votes, they don't have the votes, but then we also saw what might be called Plan C today, where they turned and said, okay, let's just repeal it and come up with a solution down the line, but let's at least sort of follow through on our promises and knock this thing off the books. And then you saw almost immediately three senators come out and say, no way, we're not voting for that. So that Plan C was dead in the water within hours of it being announced. For this to be viewed as anything other than an extraordinary success for President Obama and the way the bill transformed our views about what the healthcare system should do and the benefits it should bring is just inaccurate and a fantasy.
Well, do you think, though, that if just trying to figure out which of the many statements he made is the intention, even though, as you pointed out, the third option that Mitch McConnell presented, which is repeal now and replace later, and he basically wanted a straight repeal bill to take effect in 2 years, during which time the Republicans presumably would figure out a replacement. And already, as you mentioned, Republican Senators Collins, Murkowski, and Shelley Moore Caputo have vetoed that. So that one's dead in the water. But the one thing that he said that I find quite alarming was basically cutting loose by repealing it right now and figuring out how to replace it. You essentially throw, what, 22 million people to the wolves?
Yeah, I think, number one, the idea that somehow a plain repeal bill would be more favorably received than the Senate bill is preposterous, because the main objections to the Senate bill were that it was just too cruel. Repealing the bill now with nothing to replace it would throw the insurance markets into dramatic disarray and would make things much worse, I think, than the Senate repeal bill did. And that's one of the reasons why it was so quickly trashed in the water. Let's also remember that Trump himself said from the beginning he did not want to just repeal and delay. He wanted to put something, quote unquote, better in. The Republicans have shown us that it's actually very difficult to come up with something better. And it's not at all clear that had they had 2 years, they'd be able to come up with something better. I think what everybody realizes now is that the Affordable Care Act has some very useful things and some things that need work, and call it whatever you want, call it a replacement, call it an amendment, call it a stabilization bill. What the Republicans need to do now is be the grown-ups in charge and work with the Democrats and try to fix the thing. We all know the bill has some weaknesses, and I think now it's time to turn the page and turn to those weaknesses rather than continuing to play the kind of political games that we've been seeing since January.
But is there a subtext here? I mean, in a sense, one wonders the extent to which the Republican lawmakers are in a bind, because, first of all, it doesn't seem like the White House is showing any leadership, and nothing but chaos, as far as I can tell. So far, in spite of these extraordinary claims that Donald Trump made yesterday about all the legislation he's passed, very little has passed. But what has passed, to my mind, is very much kind of the Koch brothers' agenda, crippling the EPA, getting out of the Paris Accords, opening up the Canadian tar sands, opening up offshore drilling, getting rid of the tax cut in the Affordable Care Act, et cetera, which, of course, now has been reversed to some extent. Is there an explanation in that? In other words, are they caught between their donors and their voters?
I think it's a couple of things. I think it's more than just the donors and the voters. It's also the industry. I mean, what we saw in the last few days was actually all sectors of the health industry coming out and opposing the Senate bill. And yes, some of those are donors and some of those are voters. I think when it comes to healthcare, the president, you're correct, is sending a lot of mixed messages. Yesterday he was saying, let's have a bipartisan fix to it. They can't do nothing. One of the reasons they can't do nothing is, despite the fact that the president has said that the Republicans don't own the bill, the Republicans are directly responsible for the mess that we are in now, because as you and I have talked about previously on this program, it was the Republicans that cut off the funding to the Affordable Care Act that was necessary for the insurance markets to be stable. And it was the Republicans' actions, those same actions, that put the insurance markets into disarray, that raised our premiums and led to the kind of instability that we have now. So for him to say, we don't own it, we can let it fail, so we don't need to do anything about it, That's inaccurate, and it's irresponsible. The Republicans should take responsibility for what they did, and they have to put that money back into the insurance market, and they have to stabilize the bill. You saw the insurance industry coming out in the last few days saying precisely that. And you're seeing some efforts in the states that seem to be directed at that same idea of let's get these insurance markets stable, and let's sort of get things back on track.
But given that they own it now, in spite of the president saying that he won't own it, I'm not going to own it, I can tell you the Republicans are not going to own it. And then, of course, he does blame Obama still. He blamed Obama again today. But they do own it. But to what extent can they sabotage it?
Can they continue to sabotage
it? That's what I mean, yes.
Well, what's happened so far is that the Affordable Care Act actually had essentially three fundamental funding streams that were necessary to stabilize the insurance markets as the Act's transitional effect took hold. Over the past several years, through a House lawsuit and through some legislation proposed and passed by Senator Rubio, those funds were cut off. Virtually everybody agrees that those funds need to be turned back on for the insurance markets to restabilize. Also, I think most people agree that the Affordable Care Act, as drafted, had a weakness, which was the subsidy amounts for the private individuals buying their own insurance. Those were set too low. More money needed to be appropriated for that. Of course, in this political environment, the Republicans were not going to put more money in. But any part of a fix would entail turning back on those faucets, turning back on the money they shut off, and then adding some more money to help individuals buy insurance. That will stabilize the private market. It will bring more customers in. It will bring the premiums down, and then we can see how this act works when it's properly funded. You have to remember that we haven't seen how this act works when it's properly funded, when it's properly functioning, because it hasn't been fully funded for at least the past 3 years.
Well, going back to the number of governors that refused Medicaid expansion, is that a kind of harbinger of what the Republicans are suggesting here in terms of giving out block grants to states and devolving it to the states? Because my understanding is that the federal role has always been there as a way to stop the states from basically doing what they did in terms of Medicaid expansion.
Well, if I understand the question correctly, I think that there are two parts to it. One is on the ground, the facts about how many Republican governors refuse a Medicaid expansion. The fact of the matter is that as we were going to the election, we were starting to see the tide turning. A significant number of red states had already started to expand, including, by the way, Vice President Pence, his own state, Indiana, had expanded Medicaid under his watch. You started seeing Republican governors negotiating special deals for Medicaid, constructing Medicaid programs to fit their states, and in some ways be more consistent with their philosophy. There were components like privatizing Medicaid. Some governors wanted workforce requirements. You know, under Medicaid and the Affordable Care Act, the Trump administration still has that authority to work with states to execute waivers to help them design the Medicaid programs the way they want. I think once the political mess passes, you're going to see more Republican governors coming to the table, coming to talk to Secretary Price and to talk to him about how they can expand Medicaid and what sort of the best deal is going to be. Whether that means they're going to allow some states to use a different funding mechanism like a block grant or capitation, I think remains to be seen.
Well, it just always seemed to be a more of a political objection to Obama and Obamacare than it was, in effect, you know, that you are, governors are in effect denying their poorest citizens health care. And I'm wondering whether that kind of attitude, if that's the right way to put it, prevails here in terms of what they're suggesting. It seems that the federal role has always been a stronger one in terms of forcing states to do the right thing.
I mean, I would not put it that way. I think that historically, the way the federal funding has worked when it comes to healthcare has been optional in terms of it's enticing states. Remember, Medicaid was enacted in 1965. Mm-hmm. The last state to adopt it was Arizona in 1982. Right. So it's not like these federal funds are out there and immediately states get forced to expand their populations. The fact of the matter is that governors have their own political interests. Governors are ultimately responsible for state budgets. When times are hard, it's very hard for governors to cover their own health care costs without federal funding. So, yes, I think it's realistic to think that states actually do need federal assistance to fund their poorer populations. I don't think that most Republicans would want the federal government to federalize Medicaid as we federalized Medicare and took it over, even though that would effectively take that obligation off the state's books. So instead, you have states that want to continue that control but still need federal funding, especially when times are rough and state revenues decline. You have to remember one other important thing is that many states have what are called balanced budget requirements. So they have to end every year even. When times are rough and taxes go down, states need federal funds to make up the difference. They can't sort of go into reserves and fund health care for their population and come out with a deficit. So what we call counter-cyclical federal funding becomes very important under those circumstances. I think the fight here, which has been very interesting, has been not necessarily over getting rid of Medicaid. We haven't heard anybody say that, but it's been how we're going to structure the financing of Medicaid. And the Republicans want a little more flexibility, and they want a structure that's also going to keep Medicaid from expanding. That's what those block grants and capitated payments would do. I think we haven't seen the end of those discussions.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes here in California, it does seem that there's been an effort to, in effect, go a different direction. And there was a flirtation in Sacramento with a single-payer bill that was more of a wish list than a bill. It didn't really come up with a credible funding stream. There is also talk of expanding Medi-Cal. So is there anything in that horizon that you find hopeful that even though, as I say, the single-payer bill didn't seem to go anywhere, at least there's a sort of impulse, it seems, for more experimentation?
Yeah, I think that most people have thought that states were going to sort of have to step up and start experimenting more with their own reforms now that it seems clear that there's not going to be any new reform or likely much productive coming out of our current Senate. Single payer has been a very hard uphill battle. You may recall that Vermont for many years was a poster child for single payer health insurance. We thought they were going to get it. They actually got a waiver from the Obama administration to do it, and it fell apart in the plan design in their own state. I think that for some liberal states, it would be great to see a state try single payer. That would be a wonderful example of the laboratories of democracy at work. Remember that Massachusetts was the state that pioneered the very structure on which the Affordable Care Act was based. So it would be terrific to see some states using the waiver powers under the Affordable Care Act to design their own programs. One challenge for that is that the Affordable Care Act provisions that would allow states to take the money under the act and apply it to their own structured program require those programs to effectively cover the same population for roughly the same cost. And that's proved to be pretty challenging and is one of the reasons why those efforts haven't been as successful as one might have assumed.
Well, Abby Gluck, I thank you very much for joining us, and I really appreciate your filling us in on this complex but really vital issue.
Well, my pleasure. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Abby Gluck, who's a professor of law and the faculty director of the Solomon Center for Health Law and Policy at Yale Law School, where she focuses on Congress and the political process, federalism, civil procedure, and health law. She has extensive experience working as a lawyer in all levels of government and clerked for the United States Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.